In other news.
You know, the towers did not burn up. They turned into powder in midair.
That's scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
You walk up to them and confront them. They can't stand that.
Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. Today we speak with author and investigator David McGowan about his book, Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon, Laurel Canyon, Covert Ops, and the Dark Heart of the Hippie Dream. David McGowan briefly spoke about the book in a past interview when we were talking about his photographic analysis of the Boston Marathon bombing. We focus this time on the book and the attention it's suddenly getting from a wide demographic. The book, Weird Scenes, reveals some very disturbing elements and connections within the birthplace of the so-called hippie movement in Laurel Canyon, California. The landscape itself is riddled with man-made and natural tunnel systems, some attached to mansions and military installations. However, the groundbreaking investigative work from McGowan, are the counterculture rock star connections to military families and the U.S. military machine all converging during the anti-war movement? Dave McGowan says the probability that all of these components accidentally fell together is unlikely. David McGowan runs the site, the Center for an Informed America, and he joins us for a two-hour interview. This is the first hour. Dave McGowan, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me. Very happy to be back.
Yeah, it's great to have you back. And, well, your book uncovers a strange realm of entertainment, rock and folk music, military intelligence, and unfortunately, untimely deaths existing in Laurel Canyon in Los Angeles during the 1960s. You also trace parallel circumstances before the 60s, but could you remind listeners how you came to write this book?
You know, as I stated in the preface of the book, it began very innocently. It was supposed to be a break for me from the insanity that I normally delve into. And this was back in like 2007, 2008, back in the days when I could still take vacations, which I haven't been able to do for quite some time now. But that year I was planning on taking a nice relaxing vacation, and my daughter the previous Christmas had gotten me Michael Walker's Laurel Canyon book, which is a very, very mainstream sort of sugar-coated version of the Laurel Canyon scene. It was a book that I'd really wanted to read because, that music was hugely influential on me as a kid. The music that I grew up with that really kind of provided the soundtrack to, my formative years, so to speak. So, I had a real fondness for the music and the era and these artists and whatnot. And it just seemed like it would be kind of the perfect, light vacation reading, something to just turn off my brain and bring back all these fond memories of the music of my childhood. And so I took it along with me on vacation thinking that, I would be able to escape all the insanity and all the weirdness that I usually spend my time delving into and just provide an escape from the madness. And instead, as I was reading this book, all of these alarm bells started going off in my head and I started seeing all these red flags in the kind of hidden in the sort of throwaway facts in the book. The little fact he would just kind of throw out as interesting, but not necessarily, very relevant. You know, just kind of these throwaway facts. And the more I read this book, the more I realized that these throwaway facts weren't necessarily throwaway facts and that they may have a story all their own to tell. I just became obsessed with finding out more, as much as I could about this scene. And by the time I got back from that vacation, I had this sort of mental checklist of all of these things that I wanted to look into. You know, he had mentioned just in passing that there was a covert military installation in Laurel Canyon. And really, I mean, just he had given it one sentence, you know, just sort of this very, very throwaway fact. Oh, you know, there was also this very strange, military facility tucked into Laurel Canyon. And he moved on, and never brought it up again. And, I'm thinking, wait a minute, let's back up here. That's That seems like it might be a little, that seems like maybe something that we might want to know a little bit more about, you know? And
right.
He referenced, you know, various unusual deaths and the military family connections of some of these people and whatnot. So that really provided sort of the groundwork for what would become Weird Scene. As soon as I got home, I started ordering every bit of literature that I could find, every book that had been written, digging up every magazine article, newspaper article, web post, just everything that I could find on this scene and combing through it, looking for more of these little incongruous facts. And the more I gathered, you know, the more it became apparent that there was a whole nother story to tell hidden in the details. And so I started doing it initially as a web series, and I really did not initially envision this as being a book in any way, shape, or form. I didn't even think it was going to be a particularly long series of web posts. You know, I figured maybe 3, 4, 5 web posts, you know, just be an interesting little diversion from the other stuff that I've been working on. But it really seemed to strike a chord with people. It really seemed to resonate with readers beyond anything else I had ever done. And I almost immediately started getting all this feedback, and the story very quickly seemed to take on a life of its own, and people were soon clamoring for more, wanting more, more, more. And so I just kept digging deeper and deeper and adding more to it, and it eventually grew into, I don't even remember how many web posts, probably like 20 or something.
Wow.
And then I started getting publication offers from publishers who wanted to turn it into a book. And I was initially quite skeptical and turned away the first couple offers because I just did not get a good vibe and just didn't get a real good feel for how they wanted to treat the material. And then eventually got the offer from this publisher in London who assured me that they would give me, you know, almost total creative control over what material went in the book and how it was presented and whatnot. And so after some initially skeptical conversations with them, we eventually came to terms and signed the contract. At long last, it is now out as a book, and it seems to be being very, very well received, which is hugely gratifying because I've been working on this thing for like 4 years as a series of web posts, and then for a couple more years reshaping it into a book and adding a bunch of additional material and, you know, adding entire new chapters and augmenting other chapters and just cleaning up various parts. And so I have I've poured my heart and soul into this thing for 6 years now. So It's very, very gratifying to see that it seems to be being very well received and continues to resonate with people and continues to find a wider and wider audience that seems to really just cross, you know, all lines, you know, gender lines, political lines, the cultural lines, you know, people from all around the world just seem to have really identified with this story. And it's been a very gratifying and very unusual experience for me because I'm not used to being so high profile as I seem to be today.
It's a really good point, and we should remind listeners that you were a past guest talking about the photographic analysis that you did on the Boston Marathon bombing, which was a very unpopular show, by the way. I got a lot of negative feedback from that.
Did you?
Yeah. From that show.
I've never been a very popular guy on the radio, which is, this is kind of a weird chapter for me because, I've been doing this for like 15 years. I think my first website went up in 1998 or 9. My first book was published in either 1999 or 2000. So, you know, I've been in the trenches for like 15 years now, and, you know, have published 3 previous books and have written book-length web post series on the Apollo moon landings, on Boston, on 9/11, there's enough material on my website that I could put out like probably 5 more books just with the material on my website. So So I've been doing this for a long time, and nobody's really cared all that much. You know, nobody's ever wanted to talk to me about, for the most part, about any of, you know, my past work on any of that stuff, on 911 or Peak Oil or Boston or, you know, what have you. There's a whole lot of stuff to choose from, but this story has been completely different, and now all of a sudden everyone wants to talk to me, and so that's been a little strange that I've suddenly attained this level of popularity that I never seemed to have before, and I'm not really sure what to attribute that to, but for whatever reason, this story has circulated much wider than anything else that I've ever done. And even before the book came out, I mean, there were people just chomping at the bit to get copies of it, and just a very strong awareness out there of this material and the fact that it was coming out as a book. And yeah, and that's all like completely new to me. You know, I mean, if you look at my books on Amazon, you'll see that this one has 85 reviews on Amazon after 4.5 months. Program to Kill, which was released in 2004, has been listed on Amazon for 10 years now, has, I think, 34 reviews. And I think this one actually has more reviews now than my other three books combined, which have been available and for review for like 10 to 12 years. And this one has already gotten far more attention and far more reviews and more positive reviews than any of those have ever come close to doing. So just took literally years. I mean, when my first couple of books, when they appeared on Amazon, nobody cared. You know, they just sat there getting no reviews and no sales. And it was a very, very slow process of, you know, building word of mouth and, you know, generating sales and garnering reviews. And this one, I mean, as soon as it hit the shelves, it was selling and getting rave reviews. And so it's just, I'm not used to this kind of acceptance, you know. I'm used to being either ignored or ridiculed, you know. So,
right, because the material that you normally get into is dealing with false flags, is dealing with the government or agencies or people in the military trying to put one over on the public, or the media is also involved with handling of the false flag information. And a lot of people don't want to hear that. But in this book, it's got a lot of components that probably relate to a large cross-section of people. You have rock and roll, you have psychedelic rock, you have military intelligence, you have Charles Manson, you have untimely deaths, you have the rock scene in Laurel Canyon. There's so much here. But when you began to find the untimely deaths one after the other, what were you thinking here when you were writing this?
I was thinking there's definitely more here than meets the eye, because anywhere that you find a trail of bodies, it's always a good indication that, you know, there's more to the story than what we're being told. You know, any good conspiracy, you know, going back to JFK assassination and beyond, there's always a trail of bodies leading away. And this was no exception. It was just an astonishing number, especially considering that this is a scene that in most people's minds was all about peace, love, and understanding, you know, and hippies and flower power and love your neighbor and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And yet there was just an incredibly violent backdrop to it with this just uncanny string of often violent and oftentimes, you know, very, very suspicious circumstances that these deaths occurred. To me, that's definitely an indication that there was more going on behind the scenes of this scene than what we are, you know, led to believe. Yeah, as you were saying, there are a lot of elements in this book. It definitely, far more than anything else I've ever done, has the real potential for like crossover appeal, in that the appeal isn't just limited to, you know, the hardcore conspiracy crowd, which is probably true of most of my past writings. Whereas this one weaves in, you know, all of these rock stars who still to this day are, you know, these larger than life iconic household names, you know, that we still know and love to this day, and that you can still turn on your radio to a classic rock station and hear their music on a daily basis, you know. And a lot of them still have, you know, just huge legions of devoted fans and followers that will read anything written about them. And, you know, same thing, unfortunately, is true of Charlie Manson. You know, a lot of people just cannot get enough Charlie Manson. And despite the fact that there's been tons of stuff already written about him, people always want a little bit more. Yeah, it definitely does have a much broader appeal than anything else that I have written, while still being wildly controversial, but yet with much more mainstream elements than anything else that I've ever done.
David, can you paint the scene for listeners who are not familiar with Laurel Canyon and its influence back in the '60s? And let's start from there, and then we'll pick a band and then some of the related anomalies. But if you could, tell listeners about the scene back in the '60s.
Yeah, well, the funny thing about Laurel Canyon is even the sort of mainstream version of that is only now really gaining any kind of widespread, you know, public awareness. It remained largely hidden from public consciousness for decades. Michael Walker and I think it was Barney Hoskins were really the first to write mainstream treatments of it, and that wasn't until like 2007, which is I was saying at the beginning of the show was one of the books that first inspired me. And I mean, I grew up here in LA. I've lived here since 1960 my entire life, and you know, I was fairly young during the Laurel Canyon heydays, but I was alive and living in the city, and you know, have older brothers and older friends, and nobody that I know who grew up in LA was even aware that this huge scene even played out. You know, in most people's minds, when they think of the 1960s counterculture and, you know, the hippies and the flower children and the music and everything that went with that, their mind immediately goes to San Francisco and Haight-Ashbury, which is seen by most people as really the birthplace and the cultural center of the whole, you know, 1960s counterculture. And the reality is that it actually began here in LA in a neighborhood known as Laurel Canyon a couple of years before the Haight even took off, produced far more music. You know, just an extraordinary number of bands came out of that tiny little geographic area in a very short amount of time. Just a mind-boggling number of bands and singer-songwriters and whatnot just poured out of there in a very short period of time. And that's really where what became known as the hippie culture really began. The hairstyles, the clothing styles, the music, and basically all of those elements actually had their genesis right here in the Laurel Canyon area of LA. And most people don't even know that. I mean, most people do not even have awareness of how hugely influential Los Angeles was on the whole 1960s counterculture, and how much of the music came from here. You know, people are well aware of San Francisco sound and of the British invasion, you know, the Stones and the Beatles and the Who and you know, on and on. But a lot of people do not know that the Byrds and Buffalo Springfield and the Mamas and the Papas and the Turtles and Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention and the Doors and Love and Jackson Browne and Crosby, Stills, and Nash and Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young and Poco and the Flying Burrito Brothers and James Taylor and Carole King and Joni Mitchell and Judy Collins and Judy Sill and David Blue and a whole bunch of others that I'm can't even think of right now because it's just an amazingly long list, all came out of this one little tiny geographic area in a very short period of time, beginning in like 1964. It just had a huge impact. Everything that, you know, the whole 1960s countercultural happenings, that fascinated me, that even the mainstream, you know, version remained so little known. And then, you know, as I discovered that there was a whole hidden side to it, then, you know, it became that much more fascinating to me. And so it's a very, very, very interesting story. you know, to a lot of people on a lot of different levels.
In your research, why do you think it was so well hidden?
Maybe because it had such a dark side. I don't know. It's very strange that it took until like 2007 for a lot of this stuff to start reaching, general awareness. It seems very odd, you know, doesn't it? That such a huge scene, such a hugely influential scene. And when San Francisco first started, they were actually playing the album, you know, I mean, the soundtrack, until they had their own stuff going with the Grateful Dead and Big Brother and the Holding Company and all that. The sounds originally were coming from here, you know, from the Byrds and Buffalo Springfield and the Doors and Love and all that. So yeah, LA was actually much, you know, in the grand scheme of things, LA was there first, produced far more of the music, and like I said, really provided all of the groundwork for what people would later associate specifically with the San Francisco scene. Even to this day, why even native Angelenos remain unaware of it, it's a fascinating question. I don't know that I fully have an answer for it.
What would you say to those who would maybe say it's normal for bands to be secretive, to be strange, and odd things happening within a counterculture or a cultural movement in music? It's normal. You're going to dig up all kinds of things. Is there something here that was very unusual than any other countercultural movement?
Well, I haven't looked that deeply into any other countercultural movements, so I don't know how different it is. It's quite possible that that's true of other music scenes as well, and that's just yet to be discovered. One of the questions and requests that I get from people constantly, like almost daily, is to look into other music scenes. You know, people have said, hey, you know, you really need to, you know, apply the same research techniques to the British invasion of the 1960s or to the punk and new wave scene of the late 70s, early 80s, or the Seattle grunge scene of the 1990s, or, you know, what have you. And I'm pretty well convinced that if you were to do that, you would probably find many of these very same elements hidden in those scenes as well. But no one has yet done that. And, you know, whether I will ever have time to do so, you know, remains to be seen. I hope that someone does. I think that's probably very fertile ground to be mined, but until somebody does that, we don't really know whether any of these other, you know, music scenes were as organic as we are supposed to believe they were. But the Laurel Canyon scene, from what I've, you know, dug up, does not appear to have been the organic grassroots scene that we are supposed to believe it was. It appears to be something much different.
You uncovered the military intelligence connections to almost all of the band members those who were involved with the scene. Maybe they were actors and actresses, comedians, but a lot of them had these military connections. We can start with Jim Morrison, for example. You write about his dad. A lot of people knew that his father was a high-ranking admiral in the Navy. But there's more to that story that you had come out with. Can you tell listeners some of that?
Yeah, his father remained rather shadowy for many, many decades. And, Jim himself directly contributed that by routinely telling interviewers that his parents were dead, which was his way of avoiding discussing them, and to my mind anyway. And it appears to have been a very effective strategy, because it resulted in who his father actually was being kept concealed for like 40 years, which is just astounding. And I was actually the first one to dig up and report the fact that not only was he a Navy admiral, but he was in fact the specific Navy admiral who was the commanding officer of the ships involved in the Gulf of Tonkin incident. And therefore, he was absolutely a key figure in orchestrating the event, which dr- directly resulted in the introduction of ground troops to Vietnam and ultimately to 60,000 U.S. casualties and millions of Southeast Asian casualties. That fact remained buried to history until 2008 when I first reported on my website, which resulted in just a huge backlash and really caught a lot of people's attention. And the most hot button kind of fact that really sort of got this series some legs and got it out there and caught people's attention. And a lot of people were initially very skeptical, and the mainstream media ultimately confirmed that he was, that was in fact who he was. But when I first reported it, it was nowhere else to be found. And a lot of people were actually very skeptical and they accused me of embellishing the story to, make it a better story. But the reality was, and it's now acknowledged, that his father was in fact a key figure in escalating the very war that this whole counterculture was supposed to have grown up, to resist. And yet here you have the son of the guy who orchestrated the whole thing suddenly emerging as this key figure, this iconic figure of the counterculture. So there was a very strange juxtaposition there, to say the least, that like within months of his father sailing off and playing a key role in orchestrating the escalation of the war, you had the sun emerge in Laurel Canyon, on the Sunset Strip as a key opposition figure without ever acknowledging who his father actually was. That was one of the key facts that really cemented in my mind that there had to be much more to this scene than met the eye, because that was just too strange a coincidence that, the father and son could assume these completely opposite roles at essentially the same time. From there, then I began looking at other key figures, and it was just astonishing the degree to which the people who emerged as the biggest stars or as like the front men or, the most influential members of the various bands, to an astonishing degree, all seemed to come from career military families and intel families, whether it's David Crosby from the Byrds or Stephen Stills from Buffalo Springfield or Frank Zappa from the Mothers of Invention or John Phillips from the Mamas and the Papas, and, all three of the lead singers for the band America, or, just on and on down the list. To an astonishing degree, it was very difficult to find someone who did not fit that mold. And then I began looking at the actors, because there was also a contingent of actors who lived in and played in, so to speak, Laurel Canyon and hung out with the musicians, the guys known as the Young Turks, who were like Peter Fonda and Dennis Hopper and Bruce Dern and Jack Nicholson and various others. So I started looking at their backgrounds, and lo and behold, it's the same pattern. And after a while, it just became a little overwhelming and far too difficult to write off as just a coincidence that such an astonishing number of the key figures and some of the behind the scenes figures as well, managers, producers and whatnot, all seem to come from that same type of family background.
What are your theories on that in the bigger picture, and maybe a psychological operation connection to the peace movement or the counterculture movement?
I'm the icon slayer. I get that a lot from people. I get emails from people like, "Hey, thanks for completely ruining the '60s for me. I appreciate it." Stuff like that.
Right.
Sorry. Yeah. And people are very reluctant to let go of their idols, and we have so few of them these days. Fewer and fewer all the time. So the extent that there are people that we want to look up to, we're very protective of them. And so people do not want to give up their idols. Get a very mixed reaction from people. They want to believe the best. And I get a lot of feedback along the lines of, well, don't you think it's perfectly natural that these these people would be, you know, at the forefront of the counterculture, because, I mean, aren't they, were probably just rebelling against their, you know, their parents' values and rejecting, you know, their upbringing. And that's why, you know, they followed the career path that they did, you know. And I'm sure that's probably true in some cases, in a few cases, but I mean, when you just encounter it time after time after time after time, and so many of the biggest names fall into that same pattern, you know, I mean, as I note in the book, you know, I mean, how many coincidences does it take to make a conspiracy? And for me, you know, I crossed that threshold a long time ago with this story, but there are people who are going to want to believe that, and they want to believe the best about their heroes. But to me, I just can't really accept that anymore, that this was just a bunch of kids rebelling, because there's just too many of them, and too few non-connected people, you know? I mean, where were all the other, you know? Another thing I get is, are you saying that these people are not talented and that they were just maneuvered into the position that they were because of who they were and who their families were? And I'm not saying that, because some of them I think are overrated, but there was definitely an astonishing amount of talent there. Okay. And, you know, a lot of the music, you know, holds up to this day. But, you know, my question is, in that time, in that place, that was an era when every kid across the country wanted to grow his hair out and pick up a guitar and front a rock band and get all the girls, you know? It's very hard for me to accept that the only, you know, I mean, the question becomes, were all these sons and daughters of the military intelligence community the only ones with the talent and the motivation and the desire to make it big? Or were they just specifically the ones who were promoted and marketed into that position? And to me, I lean heavily towards the latter. Mm-hmm. But I'm very well aware that, you know, there are other people who cut these people a lot more slack than I do. So,
right, right. Based on your research, and just want to remind listeners that we're talking about a specific area, Laurel Canyon, the Laurel Canyon counterculture movement in Los Angeles in the 1960s. The area is filled with a lot of history and a lot of strange history. It goes all the way back. You have pointed out that Harry Houdini had a house in Laurel Canyon, and most people think that he was an intelligence asset for the military. Had really the same MO in terms of traveling around the country or being on a tour, and also being a military intelligence asset. So that's fascinating. I wanted to mention also that, as many listeners probably know, that Jim Morrison's song "The End," or the Doors' song "The End," was one of the main songs in the film Apocalypse Now, which is also interesting. So it may not have been a rebellion against the parents, as you pointed out.
Yeah, that song that played at the very beginning of Apocalypse Now, didn't that? Mm-hmm. The opening sequence, I believe it was.
Yes.
So. Yeah, I'd forgotten about that. strangely enough, if anybody remembers Betamax, when home video first came out, they were the big competitor to VHS made by Sony, which ultimately lost out, even though it was a superior format. And I remember when I got my first Sony Beta Hi-Fi. They had just introduced Hi-Fi stereo sound. And I got a free copy of Apocalypse Now with the VCR to showcase the stereo sound. And I remember the first time I put it in, and I was just blown away by that opening sequence and the stereo sound. So I got distracted. I don't remember what your question actually was.
The question initially was, what are some of your theories on the military intelligence connection here with a lot of the band members, actors, and those involved in the Laurel Canyon scene in the 1960s? And you had pointed out that you had basically eliminated, within your research, some of the reasons, which was the rebelling against the parents. Maybe there was a larger picture here, a larger pattern emerging. And did you see anything in your research that connected the military intelligence aspect to maybe a psychological operation?
I mean, well, there were definitely military connections and intelligence connections to the scene beyond just the fact that a lot of the big-name stars that came out of the scene came from those families. You know, there's also the fact that there was an actual, you know, as I mentioned earlier, a covert military intelligence facility in full operation right there in Laurel Canyon. So not only were all of these people coming, flocking in from all over the country, and in some cases from around the world, some of them came from Germany, Canada, whatnot, all piling into Laurel Canyon. Not only were they, you know, so many of these people from the same type of family background, but they also just happened to converge literally around a covert military facility. So, you know, not only were their backgrounds unusual, but their choice of where they decided to congregate and start the scene was also very unusual, because it just happened to be the longtime home of this military installation, which had been there since like the 1940s, when it was originally built as an air defense facility during World War II, and then morphed into a film studio and possibly other things as well. We don't really know. It's still shrouded in a great deal of mystery even to this day, what exactly was going on at that facility. So, you know, that was another very unusual connection. And then I also found out that there was a male prostitution ring that was literally housed right there in Laurel Canyon on Lookout Mountain, and that was in full operation late 60s, early 70s. It got busted in the early 70s. And when it did, some of the call boys working there specifically told investigators that their clientele included very high-level political and military-type people, including J. Edgar Hoover and his partner Clyde Tolson, who were part of their regular clientele. So this was a kind of a Craig Spence, the type of operations that like my buddy Nick Bryant, you know, has looked into, these operations that are used to compromise politicians and prominent, you know, figures in the business community and military and whatnot, and seem to be, you know, very much along those lines. And ultimately, they also got busted for child pornography. So you also had the, you know, the pedophilia angle in there, connected to high-level government people. And you also had the guy, one of the founding fathers of the Rand Corporation, and several guys who would later become members of what is now known as the neocon cabal, or the Project for a New American Century crowd, who also just happened to be hanging out in Laurel Canyon during that era, as well as Jerry Brown and Mike Curb, who would soon become the governor and lieutenant governor of the state. And Jerry Brown still is to this day. He can't seem to get rid of the guy. Still is the governor. So you had all of these up-and-coming political figure, either established or up-and-coming political figures milling about in that area. You had a covert military facility. You had all of these rock stars and actors who were sons and daughters of the military intelligence community. I mean, it was just a mind-boggling array of connections, and all of these people, you know, peacefully coexisting in you know, this what we're supposed to view as sort of a hippie commune, but with a whole lot of military and intelligence connections, you know. And then when you add in, you know, as we touched upon earlier, the trail of dead bodies, and how many of these people connected to the scene came to suspicious ends, you know, to me, it just becomes an overwhelming case. You know, this was a planned movement. It was not the organic, you know, grassroots response to the war and other social conditions that, that a lot of people want to believe that it was.
Yes. And thanks for explaining that. The, couple things. One is, the Lookout Mountain Laboratories. There was a movie in 1983 titled Wavelength that came out.
I saw that in your email. I've never seen that. Is that on Netflix?
It's actually on YouTube right now.
Oh, it's on YouTube?
The whole thing. Resolution's not that great, but I started looking at it, and basically this couple, Actually, the girl in there is one of the musicians from the band The Runaways.
Oh, Cherry Curry and
yes.
Lita Ford and Joan yeah. Jett. I think Jett, yeah. was Joan Jett a runaway?
Yeah, she was, yes. And Kim Fowley was involved with that, right?
Yeah, well, he was sort of the godfather of the...
Right. I mean, really interesting records he put out. Strange biker records and...
Novelty stuff, and then he got the he organized the Runaways, which was his brainchild of putting these underage girls like dressed in leather and lingerie.
You would love that movie Wavelength if you can during your vacation. Check it out. They point out they talk to this former miner who helped build the Lookout Mountain facility, and he was saying that it goes like six stories down. There are all these tunnels, and they connect to the natural tunnels, and basically it's about these three aliens that they have down there in incubators. And Cherry Curry was able to hear their brainwaves or their cries, and so she investigated further. It was an interesting film. Very interesting.
It's an interesting facility, and when I first began researching it, there was very little that could be found about it at all. Even in the conspiracy community, people that I talked to had never heard of it. You know, like Lookout what? And had a hard time digging up much about it. And officially, its primary purpose was to process film stock from the atomic bomb test. They would take the raw film stock there to process it. But, that doesn't really make a lot of sense because all you'd need to process raw film stock is a dark room anywhere. You know, you don't have to fly it all the way to Laurel Canyon to this, out-of-the-way covert facility that was built as a full-function film studio with, animation department, special effects department, film vault, sound stages, everything you need to complete a complete motion picture from soup to nuts, and which is well beyond what is needed to process raw film stock, So, and they had major Hollywood talent that reported for duty there occasionally, like big names like Marilyn Monroe and John Wayne and John Ford and, these big, huge names from the golden age of Hollywood, Jimmy Stewart and whatnot. Who worked on some kind of projects there, which all of them appear to have gone to their graves without ever even discussing, because there's virtually nothing that can be dug up. Just what exactly all of this equipment and facility and all of these people associated with what exactly they were doing there, because they certainly were doing a whole lot more than processing film stock. To this day, I don't fully understand exactly what was going on in that facility, but clearly there was more going on there than what we've been told or what we will probably ever will be told.
Well, you also mentioned the film Trinity and Beyond by Peter Curran that came out a number of years ago, and that was compiled from the footage from Lookout Mountain, I understand.
Yeah, purportedly so. Yeah, that was put together from all of the various footage, different nuggets of footage that had been processed at Lookout Mountain, and some of them contain like a logo saying so. Yeah, so he was kind of one of the first people to really raise any kind of awareness whatsoever that this facility even had even existed.
It was narrated by William Shatner as well.
That, was it?
Yes. Film is
he
really...
He pops up in some unusual places, that guy.
Oh, yeah. Was there any reference with William Shatner? Because you don't mention him in your book, but did he come up?
Nothing that I came across, no. I mean, there's an amazing array of names in the index of, I tell people that just reading the index of my book is an educational experience. It's just amazing how many people were associated, with that scene, and people that you would not even expect to be associated, like people like Phil Hartman, who's known to most people as from Saturday Night Live and from news radio or whatever TV series it was that he did.
Mm-hmm.
But he had a life before that as a briefly as a roadie for Jimi Hendrix, and then as a graphic artist. And he actually designed album covers for America and Poco, I think, and some of the other Laurel Canyon bands. And his biggest claim to fame was designing the logo for Crosby, Stills, and Nash that they still use to this day. The interlocking CS and N was actually designed by Phil Hartman, of all people, who was yet another person connected to the scene who came to a very curious and unfortunate and very violent end. So it's just an amazing array of people connected to this scene. Rock stars, actors, politicians, porn stars, serial killer, at least two notorious serial killers who were very closely interwound into the scene. Just this very, very strange array of people who lived and worked together, or at least, you know, rubbed elbows in during the heyday of Laurel Canyon. It's a very bizarre story. I mean, there's just so many just strange elements to it.
Yeah, the book is a really fantastic read, and I have to say it is overwhelming, Dave. It's very overwhelming because the deaths that occur constantly, and then the consistent parallels that come up with these individuals who were there. But yeah, I didn't know this about Phil Hartman. What an amazing life he had, and certainly to reinvent himself that way into a comedian and on Saturday Night Live afterward.
Yeah. Well, Jack Nicholson was also a big, pretty prominent figure there, and he began as a screenwriter and is credited with writing two of the seminal sort of countercultural films of that era, The Trip, which was supposed to be a cinematic interpretation of an LSD trip, which was actually filmed in a house in Laurel Canyon and featured his fellow Young Turks, Peter Fonda and Bruce Dern. And he also wrote Head, the Monkees movie.
Oh, wow.
So you had these people doing things that you would not, that nowadays you would not associate them with. I mean, not too many people would think of Jack Nicholson as the screenwriter of two of these, trippy, goofy 1960s, countercultural films, as well as starring in another one, Easy Rider, which was another film very closely connected to the Laurel Canyon scene and featuring, the people who the personalities in and around the canyon. So it's just an amazing array of people connected to the scene and sometimes in ways that surprises a lot of people.
That film Head was some of the music in that film was really interesting. The Monkees were involved, I think, and there was a song by the Monkees or Mickey Dolenz called The Porpoise Song, which a lot of bands did covers of that song later on. So
the music in that is actually very good. I was surprised. The Monkees have long been maligned as a fake band and whatnot, but they all of the members were actual musicians. Well, I don't know about Davy Jones. He came from Broadway, but the other three were actual musicians, and they did fight for creative control of their material and eventually were allowed to, write their own songs and whatnot. And, the music on that movie is actually pretty good. I hate to admit it, but, and there's other Laurel Canyon people that pop in and out of it. Frank Zappa, I think, makes a cameo in there. And, I don't know, a couple other people, I think. So, there was a whole branch of Hollywood that was very closely connected to that scene, and and the movies were very much a reflection of that. Quite a few of the movies, especially Head and Trip and Easy Rider, were all very, very closely connected to that scene, and all those people, of course, also come from very unusual backgrounds, like Bruce Dern, who has an uncle who was in Skull and Bones and whose godparents were Adelaide presidential candidate Adlai Stevenson and sitting First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt were his godparents, you know. So, I mean, he's very tightly wound into the Washington power structure. And, you know, and again, that's not unusual. That's par for the course for all of the people, you know, who had a very high profile. You know, Dennis Hopper acknowledged that his dad was a career intelligence officer going all the way back to the OSS, pre-CIA. It's just mind-boggling how many of them come from that background.
It is. Earlier, you mentioned Nick Bryant, author of Franklin Scandal, A Story of Power Brokers, Child Abuse, and Betrayal, and he's been a past guest on the show. He wrote the foreword of your book, and his book exposed the anatomy of a cover-up and funding structures of child sex trafficking rings. Can you tell listeners how you know Nick?
Nick first contacted me. It was either while he was working on in the book or he had recently completed it and was waiting for it to be released, I believe. And, you know, he had come across my name in his research, you know, in connection to the Finders and McMartin and whatnot. I don't remember what the initial conversation was, but he sent me, I believe, either he or his publisher sent me a copy of the book once it was released, and I read it, and I thought that he had done a really good job with it. I thought it was much more readable and much more credible than the previous treatment, which was done by DeCamp, the Nebraska state senator, I think he is, or was. And we've kept in touch ever since. I've never actually met him because he's on the opposite side of the country. He's a New Yorker, and I'm a Angelino, and never even been to the Big Apple, and always kind of wanted to, but had never made it over there. So we've never met, but we talk on the phone pretty regularly and email back and forth, and he sends me any information that he digs up that he thinks might be of value to me, and vice versa. And so when my publisher approached me about finding someone to write a foreword, asked me if I knew anyone that would be willing and was qualified to, you know, write a nice foreword for the book. He was pretty much the first name that came to my mind, and so I called him up and asked him, and he, even though he had other projects of his own going on, he readily agreed, and I wrote a very nice foreword. I like what he did, so nice addition to the book, one of many additions to the book that were not part of the original web series. One reviewer on Amazon just blasted Nick, apparently thought he was the author, and wrote a withering critique, specifically referencing Nick. I'm thinking, wow, if you're going to trash the book, at least trash the right person. <You know?
laughs> Well, Nick's done really excellent work, and you mentioned in an earlier conversation how it's been the Franklin scandal was a detriment to his career, and that really sucks for him. But in a lot of ways, you were in a similar spot, so you can climb out of it.
To some degree, Nick's a lot bolder than I am. Nick is much braver. I get most of my information from the printed page, you know. I mean, most of what I put out has been put out there previously. You know, what makes it controversial, is, as I explain in the preface, is the way that I put the pieces of the puzzle together. You know, I mean, like I say, a lot of the facts that are in this book were in other books presented as like little throwaway facts, and it's only when you gather enough of these together and put them together that you can start to show that they're not anomalies, that there is a very clear pattern that these facts establish. So my research is a little different than his in that I mine existing sources, whereas Nick's not afraid to go out and knock on doors and talk to people that I would not want to have anything whatsoever to do with. So he's a little bolder than I am, but he's also a lot bigger than I am. I mean, he told me he was like 6'3" and 220 pounds or something. He used to play football in college or something. So,
yeah.
He's able to take care of himself, you know, presumably so, but some of the accounts that he tells in Franklin's scandal, I'm just thinking, you did what? What were you thinking? Going to talk to these people. So, yeah, he's a little braver than I am.
Dave McGowan, author of the book Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon, Laurel Canyon Covert Ops, and The Dark Heart of the Hippie Dream. This concludes the first part of the interview. Can you tell listeners where to get your book?
Well, my preference is that you get them directly from me. It's definitely much better for me. I get a much better, much higher rate of return on the books that I sell myself than on the ones through Amazon. Highly recommend that you get them directly from me through my website, which is the Center for an Informed America at www.davesweb.cnchost.com, or you can find it just by Googling my name, Dave McGowan or David McGowan. It's generally the first link that comes up. And there's an order page on my site where I am selling both Weird Scenes and Program to Kill, either individually or in discounted prices for multiple copies or for a combination of one of each. And all prices include all applicable taxes and packaging and shipping costs. I'm not quite at Amazon's price point, but I'm very, very close, actually. And mine are signed, whereas theirs are not. So if people are willing to spend an extra buck or two for a signed copy, I very much appreciate them coming directly to my website and ordering through me. And I mail them out the next day. The post office is just like 2 blocks from my house, so I stop there every day and drop them off so I can guarantee very speedy shipping. And that is my first preference. Support your local bookstores because they are a dying breed.
Indeed. Dave McGowan, thank you so much for being on In Other News.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the guests.